From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the latest on the DACA debate in Washington with NPR's Mara Liasson.
And we'll talk about recent education developments with Rachel Morello and then learn why bugs should become a dietary staple.
Insects are much more environmentally sustainable than traditional livestock. They require less land, feed, and water to survive and thrive, but they're basically nutritionally equivalent.
And 3 years ago, it was tough sledding for the U.S. Olympic speed skating team. But members say 2018 looks to be a lot different.
We're really prepared. We're really focused. Our team is jiving really well together. We've really grown into a really great relationship with our coach. And everything's going pretty phenomenal at this point.
And our Bubbler Talk segment explores the Cream City. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. A little more than a week after the Trump administration announced it is ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA and the White House are back in the news. The president and congressional Democrats both said a deal to legislate DACA might be at hand.
That runs counter to what congressional Republicans are saying, or some of them anyway. It is a lot to process, but we are fortunate to have someone here to help us make sense of things. Filling the news analyst chair this morning is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So it's sounding like a typical week in Washington.
Sorry for laughing.
Exactly. In that there are a lot of people ostensibly in power who don't really know what's going on. On Wednesday night, all indications were that Democratic congressional leaders had come to some kind of an agreement with President Trump over protecting the so-called Dreamers. But by Thursday morning, there were conflicting signs. And Thursday afternoon, more conflicting signs. What do we know about what's going on here?
Well, what we know is that Donald Trump is very impulsive, and he often says something or makes policy or gives members of Congress an indication that he's leaning one way, and then it causes an incredible reaction. His staff kind of corrals him, says, "You got to go out there and walk this back," and he does. It's very confusing. And we're taping this. I think we have to be open with our listeners.
Yes.
That, 12 hours from now, who knows? You can update. But— It seemed as though he was saying to the Democratic leaders that he was open to legalize DACA, meaning make the young people who were brought here as children illegally. They've had certain legal protections from President Obama under an executive action. He would ask Congress to legislate that in return for getting some more, quote, border security. In the past, he has been very adamant about the wall, even suggesting several times that he would shut down the government if he didn't get wall funding. Now it seemed as though he was giving that up. Now, that is perfectly consistent with what we've heard from other administration officials this week that said, of course, we want the wall, but we're not necessarily going to say it has to go into the DACA bill. So that was not a big surprise. But for the president to come out this morning and saying, well, we'll do the wall later— that only communicated to members of his base, many members of his base who are really anti-amnesty, anti-immigration reform, that he was betraying them. And there was a howls of protest. Breitbart headline, Amnesty Don. And then he came out and he said, no, of course we're going to have the wall, but not necessarily. He still didn't say it had to be included in DACA. But he said, if we don't get the wall, then we're going to become the obstructionists. He was on a lot of different places. The other thing that was amazing is that a White House spokesman, Lindsay Walters, told CNN that Trump, quote, will not be discussing amnesty, but he will discuss, quote, legal citizenship over a period of time for these kids. That's what amnesty is, by the definition of the people who don't want it. So very confusing. Republicans in Congress once again were blindsided by an agreement the president made with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, his new BFFs, and they are shrugging their shoulders. They're confused, but they're basically saying, hey, you know, we're going to write legislation and we're really interested in hearing what the president wants to do. But I think what you're seeing is Congress reasserting itself They're going to write the legislation. They have to provide votes. You're going to have Republicans voting for this if you want it passed.
Right. It sounds like a lot of this is fuel for Speaker Paul Ryan and the Republican congressional leadership to say, hey, you still can't cut us out of any deal.
That's right. Now, it was a little bit different when he made the first deal that he blindsided them with to fund the government for another 3 months till December 8th and raise the debt ceiling and include hurricane relief. That was a little bit different because these were really pressing issues. You had to raise the debt ceiling. You had to give relief to Harvey victims. This is a little different. When the president initially, with the help of his new chief of staff, John Kelly, who's bringing order and discipline to the extent that he can to the White House, basically said the president was going to rescind DACA, but he crafted a kind of escape hatch for Congress. He said, we're going to give you 6 months. The president's going to rescind it, but he's not going to do it for 6 months. You have 6 months to fix this problem, Congress. Go to it. So that's what they were going to do. And Paul Ryan had met with Nancy Pelosi yesterday to start discussing this. But then the president, who is impatient, kind of jumped the gun.
Right. 6 months or 6 days here.
6 months or 6 days. And it seemed as though he wanted to move faster.
What's in it for the Democrats to be working so closely with the White House?
Well, the interesting thing for Democrats is that they all of a sudden have become players. They're a minority party. They don't have the votes to do much of anything. But the president agreed with them on how to deal with these fiscal issues, at least in the short term. That gives them a lot more leverage on December 8th when some of these must-pass issues like funding the government or the debt ceiling come up again. They can now attach DACA to any of these must-pass things like the government funding bill. Whenever the president agrees with them and they don't have to give up anything, they didn't have to agree to the wall, they come out winners. As a matter of fact, Republicans were joking today that the art of the deal means giving Nancy Pelosi what she wants.
Well, OK, so pardon me for being confused here, but in the background,
we all are.
There are various Republicans who are likely to face primary challenges next year. And when we look at some of the challengers that the president has endorsed in the past, they are often well to the right of the establishment candidate. So how does that square with this work he is doing with Democrats who are decidedly to his left this week?
Well, the president was never ideological, and the whole idea of Trump was that he was going to burst these boundaries, and he was a populist, and he would make this grand coalition, at least as Steve Bannon described it, of the working class, minorities, you know, white working class, and it would be anti-trade, restrictions on immigration, pro-manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what happened. The president came in and he basically contracted out his policy agenda to the hard right wing of the Republican Party on almost everything, with the exception of trade, where he has more in common in some ways with Democrats. Certainly on immigration, he's been that was his stock in trade. That's how he won the White House, you could argue. That's how he even came to prominence in the political arena, by being the original big birther, you know, the kind of nativism, white identity politics, questioning whether Barack Obama was born in the United States. So he always has said that he was willing to make deals with Democrats and that he would make deals with them, particularly on infrastructure. Now, that, of course, hasn't happened yet. But in terms of what the president is doing, the president sees, I think, everything through a very personal lens. The White House would spin it at he's just going to do what's best for the American people in any instance, but the president sees what's best for him. He didn't like, I think, the press coverage that he couldn't make any deals. He came back from the summer. He hadn't made any deals. And there was a headline in The New York Times about that. Well, guess what? The next day, he made that fiscal deal with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And he was very happy, he told them, with the press coverage that he received on wherever it was, Fox and Friends or Morning Joe, that he had made a deal.
This sounds like we're going into the fall of odd bedfellows here.
Yes, but we can't apply the old rules. Yes, we're going into the fall of odd bedfellows, but the president isn't a Republican. He never was a Republican. He says he's conservative, but the president is a party of one in many ways. And what's interesting is over time, he had been getting more and more isolated with his base because almost everything that he was doing was for his base. Now he's done something that potentially might cause a rift with his base to walk away from the kind of strong anti-amnesty hard line on immigration, the promise during the campaign to rescind DACA. These kids must go home, he said. Now he says they're great kids or great young people and he wants them to stay. So you can't see the president as a leader of his party. As a matter of fact, that's what makes Republicans so nervous, because not only has he praised challengers to sitting Republican senators, his White House, I asked this of the White House legislative director the other day, will not promise that he will stay out of primaries. That's a very unusual thing for a president to get involved in primaries of his own party. And it's unclear what effect he's going to have on his party in 2018. His approval ratings are very low. On the other hand, he has very, very strong support from his hardcore base, who don't necessarily support Republicans in Congress. It's almost like a cult of personality. They're just with him. They're not necessarily – they're certainly not fans of Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell.
Well, and along those lines, I have to imagine that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are still pretty wary, because it was not that long ago that Trump turned his Twitter finger on Mitch McConnell.
Yes. Oh, he called Chuck Schumer the head clown not very long ago. And I think the Democrats are absolutely eyes wide open about this. They don't think that he really likes them or that he has become one of them. But, you know, as Nancy Pelosi said, she had the votes for the fiscal deal. She said, if you have the votes, you can do what you want. But if you don't have the votes, you're doing 3 months. And that's what she got. And the same thing with DACA. Now, they are going to have to provide Republican votes for this. But one thing the Democrats do know is that DACA is the textbook definition of a wedge issue. Very, very popular with the broad mass of Americans. They think these kids, young people, should be able to stay. Very, very unpopular with hardcore base of the president's own party. That's what a wedge issue is. It separates the president's party or a party from the majority opinion in the country.
Let me ask you about one other issue briefly. In the midst of all of this, the Mueller investigation is still going on into what ties the Trump White House may have had with Russia. That investigation has been ongoing but has been pushed off the front page. Do we know about where things are with it?
These investigations are a grinding process. They take a long time. And they do grind away at the administration. We know that Bob Mueller has asked to speak to many White House officials now, officials that are close to the president. We know that Donald Trump Jr. has already been interviewed by congressional staff. The investigation is ongoing. We don't know how long it will take, but we know that Bob Mueller seems to be doing an exhaustive investigation. He's looking into the president's financial dealings. He is casting a very broad net. The kind of people he's hired are specialists in money laundering. He's looking into the way that Russia meddled in the election, including how it used Facebook and various algorithms to target the fake news and the anti-Clinton propaganda to the exact right voters, sometimes here in the Midwest. How did they do it? Did they have any help wittingly or unwittingly from the Trump campaign? He is looking into a lot of things. I don't know when it might be done, whether he will come up with any evidence of what he considers to be a crime, whether or not he will even write a report. We don't know that. But it is off the front pages, which is probably a good thing for now for the president.
And who knows where it might be by 12 hours from now. Mara Liasson, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mara Liasson is NPR's national political correspondent. She was in Milwaukee this week to speak at an event held by the Milwaukee Jewish Federation.
After a break, we'll learn about a program in Madison that wants to change the way we eat one bug at a time. But first, we'll catch up with WUWM's education reporter, Rachel Morello. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
This is the poorest class I've had in a long, long time.
Oh, come now, Mr. Grimes. By taking it out on the boy, aren't you covering up a symptom of your own deficiency?
Safford! 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 Safford!
More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. WUWM's Rachel Morello joins us every few weeks to open up her reporter's notebook to talk about the education stories that she's following.
And she is back in the studio with us today to share some more headlines from the developing storylines that everybody is talking about, to the less reported, quirkier stuff. How's it going, Rachel?
It's going pretty well. How are you, Mitch?
I'm doing pretty well as well.
Ready for the quiz?
As ready as I think I'm going to be.
Okay, cool. Last week, I think you were 1 for 3.
I'll be happy if I get 2 for 3.
Okay. All right, so we're going to start at the state level and we'll work our way more local. So first question is multiple choice. One of Wisconsin's largest public school districts is in jeopardy of being taken over by an outside commissioner. That's if the district receives a failing grade on its state report card this year. Which district is it? Is it A, MPS, B, the Racine Unified District, or C, the Madison Metropolitan District?
I believe it is B.
That is correct. It is the Racine Unified District. You might remember the letters OSPP. That stands for the Opportunity Schools and Partnership Program. That was the state's solution for failing schools, or is the state's solution for failing schools, I should say. Lawmakers drew up and passed that program in 2015, and it basically creates a turnaround structure for struggling schools and struggling districts. And those are schools that, like I mentioned, earn an F from the Department of Public Instruction 2 years in a row on their school report cards. And like you said, Racine, kind of in the same boat now that MPS was at the beginning of last year, 2016. Most people remember when MPS was under threat of being taken over. It was kind of a mess last year. And it turned out that it wasn't going to happen because the state bumped MPS's grade up. And now we're just waiting to see if the same thing happens for Racine. The DPI is set to release grades later this fall. And we have more details on what could potentially happen if they do get taken over on our website.
All right. What's our second question?
Okay. We're going to get more local. So we've got a question about something that happened this week in MPS, and it's fill in the blank. On Tuesday, a Milwaukee School Board committee agreed to phase out the use of a temp agency in hiring more blank to work in district classrooms.
Substitute teachers.
Ding, ding, ding.
Hey,
got that one too.
Right.
Nice, Mitch. So the district employs about 600 substitute teachers, actually. They're considered full-time employees of the district. But last year, they actually had to go to a temp agency to fill some slots that they weren't filling from within. You might have heard the phrase teacher shortage. That's something we're hearing a lot in Wisconsin and in other states, too. And MPS is no stranger to that. But the Milwaukee Teachers Union has argued that MPS should fill those slots from within. So what they asked the school board to do is eliminate the use of a temp agency and actually take the people they were hiring through that process and hire them into the district. I caught up with Alex Brower. He's the president of Substitute Teachers under the Teachers Union. And we chatted over coffee Wednesday morning after this meeting. He told me his stance is that if you make subs part of the MPS family, they feel more invested and they'll do a better job working with district students.
What we're advocating for in the Milwaukee community and to the district is to create a professional class of substitute teachers. And that means where people who work more and who, if they choose to work full-time, are treated like professionals and have things like health insurance and paid sick days and paid time off. So we're saying to the district that this shortage issue will be solved if we can make substitute teaching a professional occupation that people will choose to go into, that we can draw more teachers from, but also will draw, you know, more people in and also make this, some of the folks who aren't working full-time for our district choose to work full-time to receive that benefit.
I don't know how much more you know about that. I was going to ask. And at the same time, that allows them to get benefits through MPS?
Correct. Right now, I'm pretty sure the only thing that subs get, even if they are full-time employees, is a pension after 3 years. So the teachers union is also advocating for expanding that to include health insurance and paid time off, paid sick leave, things like that. The board subcommittee that met Tuesday passed a preliminary resolution. It has to go to the full board to fully be approved. But basically, they did agree to phase out the use of this temp agency and start to work to bring people in to the MPS family.
All right. I'm feeling pretty good about things. 2 for 2 so far.
Yeah, nice job. Okay, we'll see.
Yes, we will see.
This one is pure trivia. It's kind of just something I found interesting. MPS, this is another MPS question. Every year, the district picks a sort of focus, something that they choose to highlight for the year or choose to work on. Last year, it was attendance. They wanted to improve attendance in district schools. Do you have any idea what the focus is for 2016-17?
Clean bathrooms.
Oh, that would be actually pretty good. But that's unfortunately not it. I'll give you one more opportunity because there's so many things it could be.
Playing fields?
No. Oh. It is the year of the arts in MPS. Huh? District leaders have said that they plan to, quote, redefine the MPS experience for students and for the community. They want to connect students to arts experiences around the city. And they're actually going to kick things off next week, Thursday, September 21st, with a celebration down the street from us at Red Arrow Park.
That's great. Before I let you go, Rachel, how about plugging the module on our website that lets people contribute their own education questions?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So we've started this project with myself and our two other beat reporters in the environmental and race and ethnicity areas. And basically, we want questions from our listeners. We want to know what people want to know. In my case, about schools, about learning, about school policy, what's happening in Madison and how it affects schools around the rest of the state. So people can just go to wuwm.com/education, and there's a nice little box where you can type in your question, and hopefully it's something I can look into.
Sounds great. Rachel, thanks.
Thanks.
Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. You can find her stories on our website, wuwm.com.
They say my name's a teacher, but that is what I call myself.
Among the extreme food offerings at the Wisconsin State Fair this past summer, like the deep-fried bacon-wrapped olives on a stick, was one menu option you may have missed: cricket nachos. You would be forgiven for thinking the offering was there just for its shock value, but read the fair's own food listing. Cricket nachos have all the flavor of regular nachos, but are high in protein and gluten-free. Crickets are a sustainable protein that require less water to grow, providing an eco-friendly way of eating.
And that speaks precisely to the work our next guest is doing. Our Full Plate series has told the stories of agriculture in Wisconsin all summer and into the fall. And while Valerie Stoll is based in UW-Madison, her work stands to have a global impact on agriculture. Stoll is the co-founder of MITEI, the mission to improve global health through insects.
I reached Stoll via Skype from Madison, and she explained the global imperative for her work.
So I think that agriculture today is pressured on all sides. In food production, we're facing challenges with a changing climate. We're seeing population growth. It's estimated that the world population will be 9.7 billion by 2050. At the same time, more people are entering the middle class and have a shifting preference for higher input foods like meat products and dairy products. And at the same time, agriculture itself is actually contributing to climate change. We know that 14.5% of total greenhouse gas emissions created by people come from livestock production alone. So we need to actually increase our agricultural production moving forward, but do that without further straining our finite environmental resources. So I think that insects are an underexplored and underutilized resource that we actually could put a lot of effort into, just the way we have with other domesticated animals and plants that we use for food. And we could really tap into them as a nutrition source that's less stressful and less intensive environmentally. So insects are much more environmentally sustainable than traditional livestock. They require less land, feed, and water to survive and thrive, but they're basically nutritionally equivalent. They have high amounts of crude protein, healthy essential amino acids, fatty acids, vitamins, and minerals. And actually, as Americans, we're kind of in the minority. About 2 billion people already consume insects on a regular basis, and they choose from over 1,900 edible species regularly. So there's a lot of potential for different flavors and tastes of insects with less environmental impact than traditional meat.
Well, and so, I mean, you kind of touched on this, but can you give us some history? I mean, there are cultures around the world that have included insects as part of their diet for millennia, if I understand it right. You don't have to name all, you know, 1,200 or so, but how are people in other parts of the world consuming insects today?
Yeah, insects are actually a very large industry in parts of Southern Africa and Asia and Latin America. There's a particular caterpillar called the mopani worm in Southern Africa that's traded across international borders and is worth millions of dollars, which is pretty impressive for a tiny insect that's not being farmed. It's being wild harvested. There are about 20,000 cricket farmers in Thailand that are selling crickets as their primary source of income. And since there are so many different edible insect species, people are harvesting them from the wild and also cultivating them for consumption across the world. Historically, even the Native Americans in North America ate different species of insects. And really, it's the Western cultures of Europe and the United States that have kind of abandoned or not accepted entomophagy, the practice of eating insects. But there's so much potential there that's gone unexplored in our culture.
Well, so if there is commercial harvesting of insects going on in various parts of the world, whether it's Thailand or Southern Africa or wherever, what's lacking in our understanding of this that your work seeks to address?
So I'm really interested in the potential to farm insects, both at a small scale and commercially. And that's because wild harvesting of insects, like anything, can be problematic. We've seen in parts of Southern Africa, people are cutting down trees to access particular caterpillars, for example, that are a delicacy. So unsustainable harvesting can be a problem for the environment. Also, you could damage an ecosystem if you completely remove a specific insect for human consumption that should be also a food for other animals in that ecosystem. Likewise, when you're hunting or wild harvesting anything, you can't guarantee the food safety of that product. It could have been exposed to contaminants like pesticides or heavy metal residue that could be damaging to people if they eat it. So that's why I think insect cultivation, or what I like to call mini livestock farming, has a lot of potential because you could control the feed and growth of the insect over time and guarantee that with safe processing, it's safe to eat and highly nutritious and highly productive.
Go ahead.
You know, I was just saying, I think that insect cultivation or mini livestock has so much potential that is relatively underexplored. So we've been domesticating other animals for 10,000 years or more and just starting to tap into insects as a feed source that could be farmed. Now, people are very adept at farming crickets, silkworms, for example, and honeybees. We're good at working with insects in other ways, but there's so many other edible species that might do well in a confined environment, a farming environment that we haven't explored yet.
I'm so glad you described them as mini livestock, because I feel less guilty about imagining tiny farms.
Exactly.
So what's the ultimate aim? If everything went right with your work, what would you hope would be the result?
Yeah, so MITEI, the Mission to Improve Global Health Through Insects, has really been focused on small-scale insect production in development contexts where people are already consuming insects. So I spent a year in Zambia working with communities to try and understand how they experience and interact with the edible insects they do consume and how insect farming or mini livestock might fit in. But we're also looking into the health benefits of eating insects. Here at the University of Wisconsin, we've been cultivating insects on different feed substrates and then looking at the nutritional value of those insects at the end of the day. So what I want MITEI to do is help promote sustainable insect farming as a new food source for people in places like Zambia, but also to contribute to shifting the American thought and American diet away from resource-intensive products like beef and towards more sustainable protein like insects. I'll say that a lot of people are skeptical that this is going to happen, that Americans would embrace insects because we have such an ick factor when it comes to eating bugs. But I actually think that over time, our culinary choices can change. If you think about sushi, 25 or 30 years ago, it was pretty much taboo and no one was eating sushi in the United States. And now it's everywhere. You can get sushi at a gas station. So we've really embraced raw fish. And I think with more education and knowledge about insects and more producers and chefs experimenting with how to make them delicious, I think Americans will come around eventually. At least that's what I hope.
Well, and to be fair, you're not necessarily talking about, you know, to use one example, eating crickets as full crickets. There are people that are making it into cricket flour, right?
Exactly. Yeah. One of the largest cricket producers in North America is a company called Entomo Farms in Canada, and they produce a variety of insect powders or flours that you can bake with. And so I actually bake with cricket powder regularly, and you just substitute about a quarter or a third of your regular flour for cricket powder, and you've added a bunch of protein and other nutrients to your baked good, which helps us because then we don't have to face the insect, which can be scary.
Well, so are you bringing cricket cookies into your lab?
I have brought them and shared them with my coworkers, and I usually bring them to talks when I give talks on this research to help people. You know, it's an easy first step, just eating a cookie that has some crickets in it.
So how would you imagine that the change might start to happen in a culture where insect eating is not common like the United States or Europe? How do you start to shift attitudes the way it worked with sushi?
So I think Americans are pretty receptive to understanding the benefits of particular foods. So we've seen there's really good nutrition messaging around things like goji berries or kombucha and things like that that take off in niche markets initially because there are certain consumers who are interested in the benefits of that product. And I think we're seeing, especially with millennials, getting more invested in where their food comes from and the environmental impacts of their food. There's a growing interest in more sustainable food, particularly protein. And so if we can get the messaging out about edible insects, number one, and then number two, I think, is making them delicious and making them easy to use. So I definitely agree with skeptics who say that, you know, Americans are not going to start crunching on whole insects anytime soon. But with all of the added value products like insect powders and insect baked goods, you can get an Exo bar today, which is a cricket bar, like a power. It's similar to a power bar. I think messaging and repackaging those insects in ways that Americans are more used to consuming food will be really beneficial moving forward.
I have to say, it's a surprisingly, or at least surprisingly to me, fascinating topic. And Valerie Stoll, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
Valerie Stoll is a doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she is the co-founder of MITEI, the mission to improve global health through insects.
You can see a slideshow of the project MITEI is involved with at WUWM.com. She spoke with us as part of our Full Plate series on agriculture in Wisconsin, and you can find all of those stories at WUWM.com as well.
The U.S. National Speed Skating Team is preparing for the Winter Olympics at a camp here in Milwaukee this week. We'll catch up with a couple of medal hopefuls with Milwaukee ties when Lake Effect continues right here on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The 2018 Winter Olympics are 5 months away, which means that Winter Olympians and would-be Winter Olympians are into the home stretch to get ready. The country's fastest long-track speed skaters are in Milwaukee at the moment in preparation for the Games in South Korea next February.
The U.S. National Long Track Speed Skating Team wraps up a 10-day training camp at the Pettit National Ice Center on Saturday. That's also where the Olympic trials will be come January. The goal for the team is to put in a much better showing than in Sochi back in 2014. Two of the Olympians who grew up in the sport at the Pettit are with us in the studio, speed skaters Sugar Todd and Mitch Whitmore. Sugar Todd, welcome back to the show, and Mitch Whitmore, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Mitch Whitmore, this is your third Olympic cycle. Sugar Todd, this is your second, correct?
Correct.
How does getting ready for the 2018 Winter Games differ from how you and the team have prepared in the past, if at all?
I think this go-around, our team is really dialed in, and especially following Sochi, we've really covered all of our bases, and there will be no sort of missteps or any idea of what could possibly go wrong. We're really prepared. We're really focused. Our team is jiving really well together. We've really grown into a really great relationship with our coach, and everything's going pretty phenomenal at this point, I would say.
I got, you know, when we were talking out in the lobby before we came into the studio, I asked you how it was going, and it was like an unqualified great.
Yeah.
And that's saying something.
People keep asking me, like, how training's going, how's the team doing, and there's just no buts about it. I think we're all doing really, really well, and I'm really excited for this season.
Mitch Whitmore, do you feel that too?
I do. I think, just as Sugar said, it's been a nice buildup over the past 4 years from our coaching staff all the way down to us. Like, everything has been dialed in to make sure that we perform in 2018.
Well, and I don't want to do a postmortem again on Sochi because I think those were all done in the year and a half, 2 years, 3 years after Sochi. But when you were just saying that, you know, you took apart what happened 4 years ago or 3.5 years ago at this point, and you're making sure none of that happens again. What are the kinds of things that you're talking about? What are what are the things that haven't been left to chance this time around?
We're recreating. So last year, for example, we followed pretty much to a T what our plan will be for this Olympic season with training camps and travel and preparations. So last year was kind of a test run for us and working out any sort of kinks we might have had then. So this year can just be smooth sailing. So we'll do the same training camp here in Milwaukee prior to leaving for South Korea. And just little things that you might not think about, like what kind of food will we be eating when we're on the road and, you know, who's going to be taking care of our blades and stuff like that. It's all been mapped out. So there's really nothing to worry about at this point.
What kind of food are you eating on the road?
Like even little things like having blackout shades and being prepared for sleep that way. Or like she said, the knowing what food is going to be prepared. But like we had our nutritionist come here for this camp and prepare the meals or practice the meals really to see if, you know, they worked. And then just copying that in January when we come back.
I was just listening to somebody talk about sports nutrition, and they were saying that like the two, the thing that sometimes people forget about is that the athletes have to want to eat the food.
Yeah, that helps if it's edible. But obviously nutrition is the big part of that.
Yeah, and we have a phenomenal team nutritionist, and she goes kind of above and beyond. She's cooked in some very sketchy situations on a hot plate on the floor in hotel rooms in Russia. So she had kind of like a full kitchen here where we were staying to make meals for everybody.
She saved our lives on that.
Now, I saw an Instagram picture of you at the Brewers game the other day. It did not look like sports nutrition.
That is a different kind of nutrition. That's fun nutrition.
You gotta have a little fun with it, and when you're in Milwaukee,
can't come home and not have a brat.
So, okay, let's talk about the differences. Both of you kind of grew up skating at the Pettit. You both train at the Utah Olympic Oval now. How does it differ? I mean, what's a week in the life training at the Pettit? How does it differ from what things are like in Utah?
I'd say the workouts generally are the same. Since we trained here, we've evolved as skaters. We've gotten better.
One hopes, yeah.
Yeah, training with the national team over the past 5 years has, you know, pushed us to a new level. But the biggest difference is that Salt Lake is at altitude and Milwaukee is not. And so the ice conditions are a lot different. Like here, you really have to work through the ice, especially on doing anything laps-wise.
We call it work ice.
Work ice. And it hurts more.
Is it like skating with weights?
It's just kind of a different kind of skating. You have to keep your tempo and rhythm up. You're not getting any free speed from the glide on the ice. You kind of have to keep throwing in your strokes to keep your speed up. So.
And to give you an example, like our 500 takes about 34 seconds. And for here, it would be about 35 seconds. So around a second difference.
One whole second.
Which is a long way, though, in our sport.
So what's the elevation in South Korea?
I think pretty similar to here. So we had a test event there last year, the World Championships, and the ice there is a pretty good quality, I think, for a sea level rink. And the ice maker here, Paul, is really good at his job, and he's going to try to mimic the conditions that we had there here during this time, and then also our camp in January, just so we're better prepared.
Sugar, the last time we talked, you were still getting through an injury. And Mitch, I gather you just were getting through an injury of a different sort. Talk about how your bodies are feeling at this stage in September of 2017.
We're getting old, man.
Well, yeah, you guys are like the veterans on the team now.
We're our late 20s. We're really crushing it.
It's up there.
Turns out, yeah, years and years of speed skating will lead your body to revolt a little bit. But I'm actually doing really well. I would say within the last even month to 6 weeks, I have finally started feeling like I will be normal again. My knee will be normal, and it's been performing for me, and I've stopped pretty much making any modifications whatsoever with my training program, and I'm doing the most volume and intensity I've ever done on the ice. So it's been kind of exciting. Last year was a real doozy of a year for me. I didn't really have a ton of fun, and it was kind of a big question mark as to whether or not the knee surgery I did was worth it, and I can now say definitively, yes, it was worth it, and I'm glad I did it, and the timing could not be better.
You broke your butt.
I broke my butt.
Mitch broke his butt.
Yeah, on August 1st at our bike camp in Montana, I crashed and apparently broke my sacrum. I continued biking throughout the camp, like I was saying, and we just didn't find out about it until the next week when I skated, and it was very painful. I was like, wow, this doesn't feel good. Got the MRI, and it turned out it was fractured in a few places. So since that time, you know, things have been pretty limited. But where I was at leading into that camp was far above anything that I had done in the past. And so I think that where I was at really set me up for going into this season. And I think going forward, I'll get there.
So what's the pain level now? I mean, you've been skating for the last week here in Milwaukee. How does it feel?
So I'm sitting higher than I normally would and not pushing quite as hard. But again, week by week, it's getting a lot closer. And I think within the next couple weeks, I'll be 100%.
So obviously, you know, conditioning is important and technique and form are important. But where does the mental game come in speed skating, and how do you work on that part?
I think the mental game is at our level probably the biggest hurdle a lot of us have to overcome, because at this point we're so well conditioned and trained, and practices are hard, sure, but we can really get through them. And a good or bad day can really come down to your perspective and how you handle your results. I think our team as a whole has gotten a lot better with our mental game. Obviously, everybody's different. But at least for me personally, it's kind of just a constant battle of perseverance and knowing that every little bit I do every day will ultimately help me get where I want to be, and trying to just maintain a very high level of positivity and probably a certain level of goofiness to kind of keep things a little more relaxed and not take it too seriously.
Yeah, the mental side to me is, and I mean, there's cliches all over the place about it, but I really do think that the mental aspect has been the biggest factor in my performance over the past few years. And just like actually focusing at practice on what needs to be changed to go faster. If you just show up every day and try hard, that's great, but you're not going to get better at a certain point. You can only have talent or effort for so long. And especially like with the injuries we were talking about, if you're injured and can't skate, there's still a way to practice. You know, if you visualize your races and, you know, use mental imagery every day, it's like you're still doing it.
Does the mental work end when the gun goes off? Do you have to be completely blank, or are you? I mean, I think what do the psychologists talk about? Flow, like you have to be thinking without thinking while you're skating.
For me, no. I think again, I used to just skate and just when the gun goes off, I just go, and now it's more having checkpoints every step of the way. I've been working with a sports psychologist on honing in exactly what I need to think about at every little spot. And I have like maybe 15 different things as I go through the 30-second race on what to work on. And if I just run through those in my head as my race is going, I have a really good race. If I forget one or just kind of like space out and give effort, then again, it's not going to go well.
Same for you?
I'm a little bit different. I don't have that many checkpoints in my race mentally, but it's definitely... It's not just turning your brain off when the gun goes off. It's kind of implementing a plan that you have put in place for your race where you're only focusing on, for me at least, one, two, maybe three things over the course of the race, and kind of almost having a mantra going in my head so I'm not coming out of my skating or worried about what my pair is doing or anything that could maybe distract me from the quality of skating I want to be doing. So the gun goes off and... It is kind of a sort of autopilot because you want to be able to just execute without overthinking, but at the same time, you have to keep in mind some of your maybe few base points that you want to remember over the course of your race.
When it comes to the Olympics, which I hear are kind of a big deal, do you have to approach the Olympics the same way you approach every other race?
Absolutely. The biggest thing that happens at the Olympics is sometimes people get a little too worked up, or, you know, they're like, this is the Olympics, this is it. But in reality, it's the same people we race all year long, every other year at World Cups. And it's the only difference is it has this, you know, this title attached to it. So I think success at the Games comes from approaching it how you would approach any other race, whether it's a World Cup or a weekend time trial at the Pettit.
You don't get to march into the stadium waving a flag at the Pettit, though.
I mean, you could.
You could. I don't know how many people are going to be watching.
Well, so, and along those lines, I mean, I wanted to ask you before we wrap up. I mean, there are a lot of us that have done competitive sports, you know, and depending on how competitive they are, you know, there's pressure on you to perform, but playing for a rec league or a high school or even a college is one thing, and a lot of that pressure is self-directed. Do you feel additional pressure when you're wearing a skin suit that says USA on it?
I think I feel additional pride. It kind of gives me this larger sense of self and kind of puts in perspective everything I've been doing and makes me want it even more, because I'm not just doing it for myself at that point. I'm doing it for an entire country, and I really like that part of it.
Me too. I really like the aspect of, you know, fighting for your country. Or competing for your country. And I think I've been putting pressure on myself over the past couple of years from our organization standpoint, or friends and family also, just trying to make them proud as well, you know.
Well, Mitch Whitmore, Sugar Todd, I hope you will bring your medals back and spend some time with us in the studio.
I would love to.
Me too.
Thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sugar Todd and Mitch Whitmore are members of the U.S. speed skating team. Todd is a graduate of Wauwatosa East High School, and Whitmore graduated from Waukesha North. He went to UWM for a time before devoting his full efforts to speed skating. They both train in Utah year-round, but they're back in Milwaukee for the national team's training camp at the Pettit National Ice Center.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk explores one of Milwaukee's best-known identities. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Wisconsin has a nickname. You've seen it on license plates, America's Dairyland. And in Milwaukee, you may have heard this moniker, Cream City. It intrigues Bubbler Talk listener Ann Bronfield, who asks, why was Milwaukee once referred to as Cream City? The answer might surprise you. It has nothing to do with the dairy industry.
Milwaukee is known as the Cream City because of the yellow cream-colored brick that were first discovered and made here in the 19th century.
Josh Ballou is tour and membership coordinator for Historic Milwaukee.
Those bricks were used for many of the buildings and businesses, breweries, schools, throughout the 19th century.
To take a look at some of the creamy-colored structures, I met Ballou at the old Schlitz Brewery Complex on the northern edge of downtown. He says it's one of many places to see Cream City brick.
This is just a good example, pretty much due to the size.
Ballou says cream-colored bricks were first produced in Milwaukee in 1835 and quickly became popular because of their pleasing color. Architect Vince Mica has a fondness for the bricks and is surrounded by them daily. He's with the Kubala Washotko Architects in Cedarburg. Its offices are in an old power plant built of Cream City brick. Micah shows me a historic photo.
And here you can see what the Cedarburg Municipal Power Plant looked like the day that we obtained it.
Micah says you can find Cream City brick in older buildings up and down the coast of Lake Michigan. That's where the clay to make the bricks came from.
Well, what we have here in southeastern Wisconsin is the glacial lake deposits that deposits these silts and clays, and we can see them along the lake shore of Lake Michigan and a little further inland. And that became a ready source of raw materials for making brick.
Micah says builders began to choose other types of bricks from other regions when trains and improved trucking gave them more options. There were downsides to using Cream City brick. It's softer than some varieties, making the bricks less sturdy. And because of their porous nature, the bricks easily absorb soot, turning them black. Micah points to an example on the exterior of the old power plant.
That rusty muffler down there, that used to be the outlet from the turbines, from the diesel fumes, and that black penetrated into the brick. And we did some testing on it, and we could only get so far with it. And we said, you know what? That's the history of the building. We're going to let that be.
Micah says these days, though, most people appreciate the historic building material and have learned how to care for it properly. And decades after the brick's heyday, the nickname Cream City is still going strong. A number of businesses use it.
My name is Greg Hutterer. The name of our company is Cream City Caramels and Confections.
I met Hutterer at the downtown night market this week where he was selling the treats. He says he chose the name Cream City to connect the products to Milwaukee, his hometown. Besides, he adds, even though it's associated with building materials, not food, it just has a certain ring to it.
We thought because there's a lot of cream used in our caramels that people who weren't from Milwaukee, who wouldn't necessarily recognize the Cream City name as being Milwaukee, would think of cows and cream in that way.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. Do you have a question about the Milwaukee area that you'd like us to explore? Well, if so, submit your question at wuwm.com, and maybe you'll be next to quench your thirst for knowledge.
That's all for the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver. We get additional reporting from Susan Benz, Rachel Morello, and Aisha Turner.
We also get web and social media support from Michelle Matternowski, studio engineering from Jason Reavy, and production help from our new intern, Meredith Waters.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.